This is the John Clayton Show.
Brought to you by Coors Light, the world's most refreshing beer.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's get going with some headlines. Well, let's go college football scoreboard. UCF now leads 24-14 over Memphis. UCF is 14th in the nation in the AACC Gome American Athletic Conference Championship. In the Big 12, it's Oklahoma getting off to a 3-0 lead over TCU. Crazy stuff going on in college football. Well, you know that Mike Leach did interview for the Tennessee job, and then the Tennessee former athletic director, as you can call him now, was now called back. They put Phil Fulmer in charge of the athletic department, put him on paid leave. You know, and of course, Mike Leach, I'm sure, just shaking his head saying, okay, I've had some crazy experiences, but that's about as crazy as it can get. Looks like, A&M stuck big money out there, a 10-year deal, $75 million guaranteed, and so they were able to get Jimbo Fisher at head coach. Now Florida State has to look for a coach and very well could go for Willie Taggart from Oregon. You know, you can see the coaching salaries are going up right now. Congratulations to O'Day. They got a 38-11 victory in the AAA championship over Rainier Beach. National Football League. Couple signings this week. Alshon Jeffery just got a 4-year, $52 million contract extension with the Philadelphia Eagles. Earlier, Corey Peters gets a 3-year, $12 million extension with the Arizona Cardinals. It looks like Aaron Boone is going to be the new manager of the New York Yankees. Baseball moves a couple yesterday. Drew Smyly and Shea Simmons were not given tendered offers. They were arbitration eligible because of the injuries they suffered last year. It looks like the Mariners are moving on from them. And those are our headlines. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Joining us right now is Dave Crosby. And so, Dave, how are you on this big football weekend, big football championship Saturday?
Ready to watch, John. Ready to watch.
What did you? It was a pretty good game last night between USC and Stanford, but you can just see that Stanford just did not have as much as USC, and so good game, 31-28, but it seemed like most of the way that USC kind of controlled it.
Although Stanford was right there, and it goes to, look, the first time they played it was a no contest game, and there's a couple of other rematches on board for the college football playoffs today, and it goes to show that you never make any assumptions on what you think is going to happen. If you beat a team once, especially in college football, it can be very difficult the second time. It took a goal line stand for SC to really secure it, although Sam Darnold probably made a lot of friends with that 99-yard drive late, that's for sure.
Oh, no doubt. That was pretty impressive. I mean, I tell you what, I like him, but I think it may still be wise for him to stay in school one more year.
Well, we'll see. I mean, he will basically follow the advice of those who will tell him where he goes in the draft, I would assume. And I don't know that he is really given much of an indication one way or the other if he's going to stay or if he's going to go. I agree with you. I think that he has shown a game that requires a lot of work still to make it to the next level. So I would think that he would be back next year, but that's unless he hears that he'd go awfully high in the draft. Maybe he'd go pro.
Yeah, well, I think.
What do you think his status is now?
I think he's still a top pick in the draft. You just look, and he comes out of more of a pro set offense than a air raid or any kind of a spread offense. He's got an arm. I mean, you can see his mobility. I mean, you saw a couple big time throws, particularly in that early drive. You know, getting the ball down the right sidelines to 88. I thought that was huge. I mean, he's got all the intangibles, but there's certainly some things with his throwing motion that still needs to be worked on. He does tend to throw too many interceptions, and you know, if it's this year or next year, I think he's going to be number one. The one thing I know from people that know him very well, he does listen to Carson Palmer and he does listen to Peyton Manning, and both are of the opinion, it's like, if you're that good, just take that extra year, enjoy college. You're going to be better in the pros if you take that extra year to learn and work, and also just enjoy yourself in college. I know I talked to Ryan Leaf for the podcast a couple weeks ago, Schooled with a Professor, and you know, looking back, actually said, you know what, I probably should have stayed in school another year. Might have been better for him.
Might have been, although Ryan Leaf had his own issues, of course. But I agree with you on Sam Darnold's case. I think he'd be better off staying in school, and I think he'll make that call fairly soon. So SC gets the win, and they move on, although probably not to the Final Four in college football.
No. I think that's going to be out of the mix. And, you know, it's although the way things are going to go today is going to determine that Final Four. And it's all kind of a big shakeup. I mean, the fact that, you know, where's Alabama? Are they going to be in the mix? And I would hope not, because having lost last week, and I know, hey, you lose one game, it shouldn't really change that. That's why they need to go to 8 as far as having just 4. But we'll have to get colleges to catch up on that. But if you can't get into your conference championship game, you shouldn't be able to get into the Final Four of, particularly if you're going to be a number 2 team from a conference or even a number 3 team.
Well, but it's not a hard and fast, John.
No, I know. That's why it's an unfair thing.
There's no rule that says that specifically, but it would require a lot of things to happen for them to get bounced out. It would require, well, starting with the first game that's going on this morning, TCU beating Oklahoma, which is not happening in the early going. It's 10-0 Oklahoma, only about 5 minutes into that one. Oklahoma would drop out, and it's not so sure. You know, they need a championship game to not provide an automatic bid, and that's possible there with TCU beating Oklahoma. It's possible with Ohio State, who is ranked 9th in the poll, if they beat Wisconsin today, not to get in there as well. So it's possible that neither Big Ten team would be chosen, although many people think even a 2-loss Ohio State team would be chosen. So if that was the case, that was the case. I think that there's a sense that beyond the bowl games, beyond the bowl championship series, beyond the playoff, you could be looking at an Alabama-Ohio State bowl game, which would have a lot of appeal to it out there. But we'll see how things break today. They got to decide it on the football field, and there's a lot to be determined.
I know this is involving college, so there should be some collegiate type of thinking in this, but is it unlogical to think that if you can't get into your conference championship game, that you should not be able to get into the Final Four in the championship playoffs? I mean, like Ohio State last year, they were able to get in. I just think that's just so illogical. I know, because now it's become more judgmental and more schedule-driven, and that's fine to a certain degree, but if the schedule's more important than your conference, and if your conference championship means nothing, like the Big Ten championship last year meant nothing, I just don't get it.
Well, John, that's your NFL mindset there, which rates all divisions as equal and all conferences as equal, which is just not the case in college football. There are going to be scenarios where Power 5 conferences are extremely, extremely weak. And, you know, you have a champion come out of it that is not really, by anyone's estimation, one of the top 4 teams, which is kind of why you got this convoluted system set up when you just got 4 teams in the playoff. It's to try and protect from having the automatic bids go in there. Now, if you want to have automatic bids, it's easy. We've talked about this many times. Just expand to 8 teams. You can have the 5 of power conferences get an automatic bid, no matter what their records are, no matter what their teams are. And then you have 3 wild card teams that get in no matter what, whether they're in the conference championship games or lose them or don't even make them. So, look, you know, you don't have a level playing field in college football like you have in pro football. So it's not just as cut and dry as, well, they deserve to be in because they represent the conference. That's just not the case. So while it's an imperfect system with 4, and 8 would be a lot easier, I mean, they're kind of stuck with this. And we'll see how it plays out today, because there's definitely a scenario, as you've illustrated, where Alabama could get in without playing in a conference championship game, and it is something that has happened before with these guys. But I get the feeling it won't happen this time.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing that's so crazy. How long did it take for Wisconsin, undefeated, to be able to get into the top 4? I mean, they were sitting there, I think, at one point undefeated in the whole season, and because their schedule wasn't as easy. And again, that's where the thing is so crazy. It's like you're talking about a schedule that, for the most part, is set up like about 8-9 years ahead or some period of time where you can't, for example, if you're Washington, know that Greg Schiano is not going to be at Rutgers, and Rutgers isn't going to be any good. And so now you get kind of an easy game. And that's, I think, again, maybe what it comes down to, the more flaws you see in the system, the better it's going to be as far as getting the advancement to 8.
Well, first off, they don't do it 8-9 years in advance. It's only about 2 or 3 years in advance, but you don't have any guarantee of what a team's going to be. And look, for example, this year, Washington's non-conference schedule was derided as the 3 cupcakes, and one of those teams was Fresno State, who was off a 1-10 season. They went 9-2 this year and played in their conference championship game last night against Boise State. So, you know, it's just very difficult to predict. And look, even with with conferences now being split the way they are, east, west, or north, south, your conference schedule can be incredibly easy, even though there's acknowledgement that you're in a good conference because the other side of it is so tough. It's what's happened in the SEC with the SEC West, I think it is, or it's the East being much better than the West with Georgia, Alabama, Auburn all in the East, and you know, not nearly as much competition in the West going on. So there are just too many variables to do it with four teams there. But so I don't believe in any hard and fast of you can't get in unless you're in your conference championship game. It just doesn't make sense in college football.
Mm-hmm. So where do you see things going now for some of these college coaching changes? Because, again, with the big deal, the $7.5 million a year deal that was secured, Texas A&M giving it to Jimbo Fisher, and now you get Willie Taggart possibly, you know, moving. If we'll see where that goes, but he's certainly one of the main candidates, if not the main candidate.
Yeah, it all depends on what he wants to do. I mean, I've made the point, we were talking about this yesterday, this is not a Mike Leach situation where you've got X amount of dollars that you can offer, and in the case of Washington State, they're probably paying him more than they can afford right now anyway. But he can get twice as much in other places. That's not the deal at Oregon with Willie Taggart. If most coaches, look, you know, you can slice any way you want. You talk about being great competitors or whatever, but Jimbo Fisher proved quite conclusively, and I don't blame guys for doing it, that they'll follow the money. They'll go where they're going to get paid the most, which is what most people do in their jobs, by the way. So if it's about that, then Oregon does not have to take a backseat to anyone. They can offer Willie Taggart as much money as they want to. Now, the real question is, does he want to go, and do they want to keep a guy who doesn't want to be there? And the answer is always, in those cases, no. But that's not normally the case. The case is normally where the most money is where you get the best coaches or where your coach will stay. So if it comes down to a financial issue with Willie Taggart, he's staying, obviously, because Oregon can pay whatever it takes to keep him without having anything slice off their back. It's the Mike Gundy situation to Tennessee. Tennessee offered basically to double his salary, offered, according to reports, over $8 million a year, more than what Jimbo Fisher got. And I'm sure T. Boone Pickens quietly said, we'll do something for you. And, in fact, they gave him a $700,000 a year increase on his existing contract right now, about a $3.5 million bonus. Nothing is created equal in college sports. Nothing is created equal in college football. Even places like Stillwater, Oklahoma, and Eugene, Oregon can compete with the big boys because they have the big benefactors. So it's just a question of how that's going to break down. It's still... You know, you've got, in some cases, you got the guys you're not considering for jobs are top coordinators at top schools, offensive and defensive coordinator. Although Greg Schiano was defensive coordinator at Ohio State, that's not what he was known for. You have offensive and defensive coordinators at Clemson, who would be strong considerations for jobs in the Southeast. The same thing for jobs in the West. You know, you've still got an interesting situation to figure out at Arizona State. If they're not going to make the cataclysmic mistake of hiring your old colleague Herm Edwards. That'll be a job that'll have a lot of appeal. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. But it's very hard to figure out what it looks like now with the college playoff thing still having to be determined. And in the case of those coaches, most guys waiting a little bit. Now Florida State, ironically, is playing a game today, and Jimbo Fisher is not coaching because. You know, it does not come down to worrying about anything more than the almighty dollar when it comes to the coaching carousel.
And I guess you can see that they're heading now into a very high period of pay because it looks like the pay for college coaches is just going to explode, and because of that, there will be more movement.
Well, sure there will, and it, of course, gives lie to my favorite argument that, well, we can't possibly afford to pay the players. Sure you can. I mean, it's outrageous to be paying college football coaches $8-9 million, the highest paid state employees in most cases in the state. It's ridiculous money. So you're right, when that is the object and there's a lot of it out there, it will lead to more movement, and that's been the case, and also leads to more impatience among alumni bases and fan bases. We've talked about this before too, where, you know, to give a college coach an honest to God try, you need to give him 5 years so he can have all of his players, all of the players that he's recruited being there, including fifth year seniors. And when do you ever see that be the case? You know, almost never. You guys get a 3-year shot like they do in the NFL, and that's it. You don't even have your own recruits playing for you at that point. So it will be an interesting carousel. You know what? We talked about the interesting name that came up at Washington State. How about if if Mike Leach goes somewhere and they actually do talk to Rick Neuheisel back there.
I know. The fact that he's...
Oh, yeah, Rick Neuheisel back involved in the Apple Cup.
I know. As much as I'd like to see that, you know, maybe can he swing his way over to Arizona State or something like that so we can have the best of all worlds, and Mike Leach staying at Washington State and Ricky back in here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they may take a look. I've got no idea what they're doing there with that Herm Edwards talk, except that of the previous relationship those guys had. So, and firing Todd Graham makes Arizona State's job look pretty unappealing, although, again, I'll reiterate what I said before, money talks, everything else walks.
No doubt, and of course it's going to be just fascinating to see how it all shakes out. So how do you, just going into today, coming out of today, how do you see the top four in college football now for the championship?
Well, I think Auburn will beat Georgia in the rematch that was won pretty easily this year by the first game, I should say, was won pretty easily by Auburn. So I think Auburn gets in with two losses as SEC champion. I think Oklahoma is going to win their way in with this game against TCU. So there you got two teams in. I think Wisconsin is a loser to Ohio State, so I'm not sure exactly where that's going to put them. I think Clemson beats Miami. Miami's a little beat up in this game, so Clemson is your third team in there. And then, you know, you're getting down to your fourth team in there. Will it be an Ohio State team? Here's where an Alabama team jumps up, John. If, in fact, Ohio State beats Wisconsin, are they a factor to get in because they won the championship game more so than a one-loss Alabama team would be? And that's where the decision would probably come down to between those two teams. And if it does, I think it'll be Alabama. So I think you're going to see two SEC teams, Alabama and Auburn, in, along with Oklahoma and Clemson.
Interesting. I thought it's kind of interesting that this week Nick Saban said it would be horrible of college football to keep Alabama out of the playoffs, whether there's a scenario or not. So, you know, I don't know of any coach that has more power in college football than him.
Well, I don't know that he has more power at Alabama. I don't think he's got power over college football, John. So Nick Saban is saying what any coach in his circumstances.
Now, who runs the NCAA? You're talking about his former athletic director who used to be here at University of Washington?
Right.
He doesn't have any power? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he does. He does. But that's all a mess, John, when you get right down
there. That I think we both agree on. So now, how are you going to handle today as far as how you're going to watch?
Good clicker management is all that's required, John, and I've got a lifetime of experience at it. And the perfect rainy day that wants you to stay inside anyway just adds to it. So it'll be an easier to stay in, and then be interesting to watch the NFL play out and then the Seahawks play on Sunday night.
It should be fun. Dave, enjoy yourself and have a good one.
Thanks, John.
Talk to you on Monday. And, of course, Bob Gross and Tom weekdays here on 710 ESPN Seattle from 12 until 3. All right, load up the phone lines because, again, we're going to be out by 11:30 for Washington State football. So we got plenty to talk about. Big game coming up, probably the biggest game of the year without question. Eagles coming in, I guess. Well, the first Ram game was maybe bigger just from the standpoint of division. But now you got Sunday night football, you got the Eagles, you got the Seahawks, you got the Legion of Boom with injuries. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com. Now, more John Clayton.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Mark in Shoreline. Hey, Mark.
Morning, John.
Good morning. How are you?
Yeah, I haven't been on your show for a while.
I know. Welcome back.
I'm still used to saying Mark from Fremont, but I moved to the Shoreline 5 years ago.
Okay. And how do you like it so far?
I think it's going to be kind of rough with the Seahawks to make the playoffs with their schedule. What do you think?
If you really look at it, the answer is no, as long as they take care of business, because even though the schedule is difficult, things kind of break to their way in the sense that, okay, the tough games are at home. I know mm-hmm. Jacksonville's a tough game, but also that's a game where they get a little bit of a break. It's not going to be the early start at 10 a.m. West Coast time. It's going to be, you know, at 1:25 West Coast time, mm-hmm. and you got Blake Bortles at quarterback. But, you know, if you really think about it, you know, if they can take the two home games, because, you know, Arizona, they're going to be out of it. I mean, that by that time in the last week of the season, and, you know, the Rams, of course, that's going to be tough. But again, they've already beaten the Rams. Mm-hmm. And so if you win the division, then you're fine. Now, again, it would have been better And that's why the Super Bowl could be very dicey, because they're not going to get a number one or number two seed unless other teams start to fall down. But you look at Atlanta's schedule. Atlanta's got five tough games coming up. I think it's 692 is their closing schedule, and that's the toughest in football. And so because of that, in fact, you have so many of the, you know, the race in the NFC South really started late. I mean, there's more division late games, you know, in December in that division than just any other, about any other. And the fact that you've got three playoff contending teams, they're going to start knocking each other off a little bit. That's why, you know, for example, tomorrow you have New Orleans and Carolina. Then Carolina has to come back, and there's other games. So that, I think, can hold things down. And if that's going to be the case, you know, you can get the wild card, maybe a 10 if you have the right tiebreaker. I still think one 10-team team in the NFC is not going to make it. But I think, you know, they still have a good chance.
Is all of their injuries. I think people are being so negative about their injuries. I've heard a lot of people talk about they don't even think that Richard Sherman or Cam Chancellor or Chris Averill will come back.
I know. Well, and say that's why, and again, I'm neutral in this stuff, and that's why I don't get into the emotion. I just try to get into the study of it, and I contended that this team is deeper, not as good as 2013, but the deepest team since 2013. And if you go into a game against San Francisco, you don't have Richard Sherman, Cam Chancellor, and Shaquille Griffin, but you can go out there and put up Byron Maxwell, Jeremy Lane, and Nico Thorpe. It's not bad. And then you have Bradley McDougal, who's better than any backup safety this team's had in a while, to be able to come in and fill in for Chancellor or Earl Thomas. You're better there. You know, they still have 10 options on the offensive line. Now, again, that's the quality is there, but now you add Dwayne Brown, that's better. So, again, this team still has talent. I mean, it started the season with 8 Pro Bowlers on defense. Now it has 5, and you know it has, you know, Jimmy Graham is a Pro Bowler, Doug Baldwin, you know, a Pro Bowler now. They got 4 or 5 on the offense. That's a lot of problems. Like, they have more former Pro Bowl players than any team in football on their 53-man roster at 13. Now, again, some haven't been there for a couple years. Some are on special teams. But still, there's a lot of talent on this team.
All right, John, thanks.
Hey, thank you, and congratulations on the move, Mark. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Greg in Ballard. Greg, I know you didn't move.
No. Hey, John, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Hey, you know, I just wanted to talk about the Seahawks for a little bit. And, you know, I think that the Seahawks are going to have to come in with a chip on their shoulder, and I'm kind of sensing it, because there's been a lot of talk, you know, from the analysts that, you know, this might be the beginning of the end of the Legion of Boom, and I just don't believe it yet. You know, I think Sherman will be back, and I hope Cam will be back. But, you know, Cliff Averill, he's got to make a decision. I think that's a way more serious injury. And
yeah, but I think what you're looking at, you may not be able to have Cam Chancellor and Cliff Averill back.
Yeah, well, I'm praying for Cam and all those guys, but yeah, it might be a reality that they're, you know, they're done, and they've done a great job, you know. But, you know, life and family is more important than football always.
Right, agreed.
But, you know, I wanted to say something about the, I know this is kind of, I know I'm a big music fan like you are, and, and I've been wondering this for a little while. And I'm kind of wondering why the Seahawks, when they come out, you know, the guy that does the music, the AV guy at the stadium, why they keep playing the same song as they come out over and over again, Bittersweet Symphony or something like that. I was wondering, you know, because, you know, what gets me going is music like, you know, Metallica and Pantera and, you know, heavier stuff. And I was just wondering, like, why they just keep doing the same song. Do you have any idea?
Well, I think if you see most teams, I mean, they pretty much, they're going to use the same songs year in and year out. Because, well, you got dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, like, you know, but that's kind of like an NFL type of song. And because, again, it's like, I guess, you know, you see the motion of the moving of the flags and all that different stuff. I guess it plays into that. I mean, again, it's like I'm not into the music selection of why they do it or knowing why they do it, because I haven't talked to anybody about it. But, it's just, you know, you go a certain way of presenting the game, and the way that the team presents the game seems to be very good with the fans, because the fans react so positively to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I just, you know, it'd be nice to mix it up a little bit, you know, with some different music. I don't know.
That's not NFL. You know, NFL, they're not into change. NFL doesn't like change as much.
That's totally true. Yeah.
I mean, you know, they like to, when you take the change in your pocket and you spend it on things, but it's slow sometimes to make changes and adjustments. It's tradition.
Yeah, like their $12 beers.
Exactly.
Hey, John. Hey, thanks a lot. I just want to tell you that, you know, I listen to your show a lot, and I just appreciate all the effort and work and time that you put in, and really like that G is on the show with you every day. You guys make a great pair.
I appreciate that.
Hey, you know what? I do think we have a shot at the game on Sunday night. It's going to be tough, but don't count out the Hawks.
Go Hawks! We'll see. And, of course, that's what KJ Wright said. Don't sleep on the Hawks. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, more John Clayton on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com.
Load up those phone lines at 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Don in Belfair. Hey, Don.
Yeah, John, appreciate the show and you taking the call.
I appreciate
it. The question I had was, I kind of concerned with some of these injuries, and I heard somebody mentioning maybe the half-speed training camps and practices are contributing, and I was just thinking, especially with some of these groin and hamstrings, that sounds like it's a possibility. What's your take on that?
Those are more just conditioning type of stuff. I mean, what you can see as far as, you know, because the soft tissue injuries, they're always going to happen. I mean, that's just going to be, you know, whether it's a twist here or a twist there. I mean, I think the one thing that I noticed tracking it, because I do, is that if you start an OTA, if you start a training camp, or you, what happens usually has an increase of ACL injuries and Achilles injuries, and so much of that, and I know this comes from talking to general managers and coaches and stuff like that, you know, that's more a byproduct. If you didn't train the tendons, you have a tendency to do that. But the hamstrings, I mean, you know, everybody runs, everybody trains, everybody lifts, and so that's just the nature of things, where the hitting part of it comes down to is you know, the shoulder injuries, you know, other injuries like that. And that's why, I mean, you look at today I had 89 starters on the injured reserve list, or I think it was like 80 on the injured reserve list, and more than a quarter of them, 22-23, are offensive linemen. And that's where you have the problems, because the offensive linemen need hitting to get their bodies ready for the daily hitting and the annual plays of hitting. And I think because of the fact they don't do it, you tend to get more injuries with the offensive linemen.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, yeah, I guess with some of these, with Davis's recent one and Lacey earlier and stuff, but just getting into this paranoia coming in, when we're going to, you know, get the next injury or a hamstring or something.
Yeah, I mean, and that's,
I don't remember.
I just counted up. There's like 200 and, there's like 320 guys that are on the injured list. Now, again, you have the PUP list and all that stuff, so it really turns out to be 336. But there's like 225 guys, and it's, of course, there's been two or three put on today that are on the injured reserve list, not the waived injured list. Because what happens is, if you get a guy injured and you just want to get rid of him, you waive him injured, hoping to get an injury settlement. But I mean, you're talking, and you look at teams right now like the Giants and San Francisco, they've got like 18, 19 guys on the injured list.
Yeah.
And Baltimore's up there with like 15 or 16. Yeah. Seattle's getting pretty close.
Yeah, I'm sure they still do the same warm-ups that they have always done.
Yes.
They've got more expertise and all that. It's just...
More science goes into it. I mean, now they put chips on the players so that they can see how their movement is and see if there's a fatigue factor that goes in. You've got more nutrition that's involved. I mean, Seahawks are about in the forefront of that. I mean, you know, they get certain type of smoothies after practice. And so, you know, a lot of science goes into it. But again, it's a big physical sport. And when you have 300-pound guys hitting 300-pound guys, guys get hurt.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, thanks, John.
Hey, Don, thank you. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Irish Mankey. Irish Mankey, how are you?
Hello, Mr. Clayton. Fantastic. And I hope you and Mrs. Clayton are absolutely wonderful today.
We're doing well.
Fantastic. Oh, Mr. Clayton, everybody wants to know what happened with Irish Mankey.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, all I can say is it was a two pint ice cream game, Mr. Clayton.
I can imagine. Had to be.
It was a tough one.
Uh-huh.
It just didn't feel right as I was watching it unfold. And I was hopeful, with the lead going into the fourth quarter, they could hang on and steal a win from those nasty Stanford team.
But it wasn't didn't happen. Did not happen.
The quarterback didn't happen.
I thought you said the quarterback was great.
He is, but he has limitations. Well, let me say this. Without him this year, they would be as bad as they were last year, even with the great offensive line that they had this year.
Mm-hmm.
This was his first year as a starter, and he's just, per se, not, his passing game needs a little work, is a nice way to put it.
Okay.
But as far as running and scoring, you know, Mr. Clayton, they only were held out of the red zone twice this year. And I think they were in the red zone over 30 times, if not more, once because they kneeled down at the end of the game, and then once with the Stanford.
So now, how do you sum up the season? Because you had your great expectations, and naturally, like every year, they fell apart.
You know that,
huh?
I'm to Notre Dame as you are to the Seahawks. You know
what is that?
Well, always expecting, even when it's the worst possible condition, as in what's happening with the Seahawks. Do you think they're just getting old?
It's starting to show. Yeah,
Isn't that sort of the tip of the iceberg here?
There's a reality to that, yeah.
The
defense is getting old.
The
defense is getting old. The offense obviously isn't old. I mean, they got...
No, but the defense. And,
yes.
And in the NFL, I think, you know, you need that defense.
You do? Agreed.
You know, I just do. So, Mr. Clayton, we are going to a bowl game.
Okay.
And it'll be probably Iowa State.
Oof.
And they are no slouch, Mr. Clayton.
Uh-huh.
We'll talk about all that next week.
Right.
I hope you have a great weekend. And how's the sideline treating you? Game shape ready yet?
What, am I what?
Are you game shape ready?
No, I never got any chance to get any workouts.
Have you gotten adjusted to the sideline?
No, I love it. I mean, I did it last year, doing it this year.
Around, do you wear cleats or sneakers?
I do not, no.
No?
No.
Just regular old shoes?
I mean, why would I wear cleats on an artificial turf field?
Well, they've got them, don't they? I think they do.
Yeah, but why would I? You wouldn't need them.
Because of all the running up and down you got to do.
I know. That's why, you know, sneakers work out well.
Well, Mr. Clayton, save your soul. Come to Jesus.
Thank you. Thank you very much. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421 ESPN. Let's go to Hank in Poulsbo. Hey, Hank.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. I'm going to refrain from screaming like your last caller,
okay,
but I
fine.
Had a few questions for you.
Yeah.
So with the fall of Richard Sherman, I was wondering, why did the Seahawks not pick up, like, a Darrell Revis? Or maybe Brandon Browner come out of retirement?
See, because you're going older, they had a better option because they were able to get Byron Maxwell. Byron Maxwell's 29. He's not in his 30s or toward the end of his career. Brandon Browner hasn't been able to get a sniff right now from NFL teams. And so, you know, that's name recognition versus reality. Now, again, maybe the Revis thing's working out. We'll find out tomorrow when Kansas City puts him out there against the Jets. It wasn't a monetary thing, but Byron Maxwell has been here. And he knows the kick steps. He knows the system. He knows all those different things. And if you watched him, he looks good. I mean, he plays very well. I mean, he had 3 days of practice, and he goes out there. Shaquille Griffin gets hurt in a couple plays, and next thing you know, Maxwell's out there for the entire game, and you didn't see any problems. He looked great, and he did well last week. And so that's one where you take the guy that knows your system, has starting experience. I mean, say, you know, he was a $10.5 million player. Now, he didn't live it up to it. They didn't maybe put him in the right spots. But you can see he's good enough to start in this league. And to be able to get a guy like him this late after the Richard Sherman injury was huge.
Oh, yeah. I agree. So, now with our kicker, Blair Walsh,
yeah.
He had the game-winning kick that he missed for the Seahawks to win in the playoffs. Why do you think he was selected by the Seahawks to be the kicker?
Because of his talent. I mean, you know, he went to the Pro Bowl early in his career. He has one of the stronger legs, and so you can, you know, you're going to get the touchbacks. You know you're going to get the 50-yard attempts. And, you know, it started out, he hit 12 out of his first 13, but missed an extra point. And then, of course, he's had the two bad games. Well, I guess, you know, one bad game was the Washington game where he missed three, and then he was short on the 52-yarder against Atlanta, which he should have made. It was hit at 51 yards. But, you know, you go with the talent hoping that he's going to have the confidence. I don't know if he has the complete confidence. I have to think that's going to be in question. But, you know, what they want is for the younger talent. They were able to get him at a good price at $1.1 million and take a chance. And so right now it's in flux to see how good that move has worked, because, again, it didn't work out as well as you would hope in the two home games of late.
Yeah.
And, hey, Hank, thank you
lastly,
for the...
Go ahead. I know that Seattle likes to get a lot of good picks in the draft. You know, they like to, they have good scouters. Mm-hmm. But why do you think that they get a lot of injury-prone players?
They got. What do you mean by injury-prone players?
You know, like, what is our running back, or well, our fifth or sixth running back right now, and they're all just getting injured.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
Luke Wilson is in and out of injury. Everybody has groin injuries. You know,
that's just the game. I mean, that's the way the game is, unfortunately. You're going to get injuries. I mean, you know, C.J. Procise has been kind of – it's been tough on that one because, again, he tends to get hurt a lot. You know, it was bad luck on Thomas Rawls. I mean, it was he had a good rookie season. He's been healthy for the most part this year. But that's just bad breaks.
Okay, yeah, yeah. And lastly, John, I was wondering if you like to play bingo.
Yeah, I don't have time, but it's like, yeah, bingos I used to play.
Perfect. All right. Thank you. Well, you have a great day, John.
All right. Thank you. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Jim in Issaquah. Hey, Jim.
Hi, John. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Thank
well,
you
appreciate that. Thank you.
I have a couple of questions. One is about the Seahawks offense, and I have this thought, and I don't know why Pete and Bevel don't do this. You know how Tom Brady and the Patriots, on first down, you know, two steps back, a quick pass, you know, like in the slot or the outside for 6-7 yards, right, to the receiver, tight end. Now you've got manageable second and third downs. So when you see the slow start from the Seahawks offense, you know, especially in the first half, even when they throw, even if they throw on first down, it just feels like they have, you know, deeper drops and they're trying to kind of have too much time for Russell. So I just wonder.
So I'll give you the answer because it's not as easy, because you've got Tom Brady 6'4". Okay, and Russell Wilson's 5'10 and 5'8". And so it's going to be a little bit harder for him to, you know, stand up and look over and throw those type of quick passes, because he's not going to necessarily have the same vision as Tom Brady. I mean, you're talking about almost 6 inches of difference right now that's going to be in Tom Brady's behalf. Now, if you're watching in the last few weeks, there is more of a tendency for Russell to be able to make some three-step drops and throw. And actually, he ranks among the better three-step drop quarterbacks in the league statistically with his completion rate and everything else. I think what was on three-step drops, and this is going into last week's game, he was something like 36 of 52. So he does some of it, but it's not as easy for him because he doesn't have the same vision as Tom Brady or a tall quarterback, because he's 5'10 and 5'8". You know, you notice it has, there's a little bit of a difference with Drew Brees, who's, you know, not 6 foot. You know, he has to do that. So you can do some of it, but you can't do it as easily as Tom Brady and 6'4 quarterbacks, not 6'4".
Okay, got it. Thank you. Another question real quick. This is about drafting. I was trying to see the offensive lineman who the Seahawks passed over, you know, when they had the chance in the first round. I think there's a guy called Ramczyk from Wisconsin who's almost like an all-pro now for the Saints. Mm-hmm. And then I think there was another one from Alabama who they could have taken, you know, when they kind of drafted down and, you know, went into the second round with McDowell. I'm just wondering, will they finally kind of stop doing that and, you know, address their first round, to use their first round pick to address their biggest needs, even if it is the line or somewhere else? Because it just feels like there's so much of a missed opportunity. And if you now look at how much money they've had to spend, right, with free agents to try to shore up the offensive line, you know, it might have been smarter, looking back, to at least just draft the best offensive lineman available.
But see, that's not, that's, and that, that can sometimes, now you're right about Ryan Ramczyk. He's come out and done very well for the New Orleans Saints, but that's not as easy as you can see. And if you look at the draft commitments that this team has made, you know, they've really spent almost more than an entire draft on this current offensive line. You know, it's a first-round pick on Jermaine Ifedi, 2 second-round picks for Justin Britt and for Ethan Posick. You know, remember they, you know, you got a third-round pick on Reese Odhiambo. They traded a fifth-round pick to get Matt Tobin. They traded a second-round pick to get Dwayne Brown. And it just comes down to, you know, they've got a fourth-round pick in the Mark Glowinski. They've invested picks, but, you know, you go back and it depends on the year. This was the worst offensive line draft in ages, right? I mean, you can't remember one. Only 33 were drafted. And, you know, you can take a first-round pick, and again, I mean, they have a first-round pick in Jermaine Ifedi. He's not lived up to those expectations yet, but it's not a guarantee if you make that move that it's going to work out as well. You go back to 2015, 4 of the 6 first-round picks drafted, you know, going right down the line, have been busts. You know, that includes Greg Robinson, who was drafted by the Rams up top near the right near the top of the draft. He's not even on a team right now. Oh, I know he's on a team. He's on waived injured. Detroit picked him up in a trade and waived him injured. So, no, it's like it's not as easy as that. It's just difficult identifying college players out of spreading offenses and air raid offenses and turning them into offensive linemen. So it's not like it was, say, 10 years ago.
Got it. Thank you.
Hey, Jim, thank you. Let's go to Jet in Seattle. Hey, Jet.
Dr. John, how are you doing today?
Doing well. How about you?
Well, my first burning question for you is, do you like to play Yahtzee?
Yeah, probably a little bit more Yahtzee than I did, do bingo.
You're more of a Yahtzee guy.
More of a Yahtzee. Actually, I'd never played Yahtzee. That was an unusual question. I was trying to figure that out.
Yeah, I thought that was rather interesting.
I mean, but, you know, it's something obviously I've not done probably since I was like in my teens.
Yeah, before you could go out and you had to stay home with all the church ladies and stuff.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. And speaking of going out, I'm worried about this trap game this week with the Chiefs.
Mm-hmm.
3-5 games left. 3 of them worry me. The Chiefs, the Broncos, and that last game against the Patriots, who may not have anything to play for, although I can never see Bill Belichick conceding any game to the New York Jets, whether they have something to play for or not. But I'm worried about this game blowing a hole in our plan for sucking for somebody in the first round next year.
Yeah, it could be tough. I mean, and then what about the Chiefs coming in with the motivation of Darrelle Revis?
You know, I'm not sure how all that's going to play out, but, man, I'd love to see Anderson blow past his fat butt and just torch him deep.
Mm-hmm,
because,
and then come back and say that Bob Anderson should be in the Pro Bowl.
Well, I'll leave that for better minds, but, you know, as far as the ad campaign goes, he better knock that crap off real fast.
Yeah, it's pretty silly. Pretty silly.
I kind of get the feeling that, he's really evolving into a very good professional receiver.
Mm-hmm.
But I just kind of get the feeling, and watching him in some of the interviews on SNY and stuff, he just seems very immature, I guess is a polite way to say it at this point.
Right.
And I'm hoping it's just a maturity question, but... he basically seems like a kid.
Uh-huh,
and, you know, so hopefully that'll develop. I think you've got a pretty good locker room. I think Bowles has been sitting on him, and hopefully you learned another lesson from that thing. Cause that can't go over very well in the clubhouse.
No, it can't. And I don't know. It's been a strange – what do you think right now? How would you judge the viability of a no coaching change or coaching change?
I think Bowles is back regardless. You know, I read a couple articles where, he's got to win at least a couple more games, or, boy, if they lose the last 7 on the way out, he's done. I just don't see it as that. You know, I think they've overexceeded expectations dramatically already.
Right.
You know, the season ended today. I don't think there's a question. And I really think they've done an excellent job both in turning over personnel and molding the personnel they have in that clubhouse compared to where it was the last year in particular.
Right.
So it's just on that alone, I think it's been good. I'm still not entirely sold on him as a head coach and a game manager. But, you know, whether they lose the rest of the games or not, again, it depends on how they play. I mean, especially if you really, they've got not a whole lot to play for. Their season is effectively over as far as any playoffs are concerned. But they still play hard and they stay in the games in the fourth quarter. Whether or not they win them or lose them, if they're still close going into that fourth quarter, you know, I think he's coming back.
Yeah, I would hope so. I think he deserves to, but because he's done a pretty good coaching job under the circumstances.
Yeah, I agree, and I also hope that they bring the substantial portion of the staff back. You know, the thing that makes me mad is, you know, and I've got some qualms with Johnny Morton's play calling throughout the year. Sometimes he gets a bit pass happy, sometimes he gets a bit run happy, and they really don't seem to do a good job adjusting at halftime. But overall, you know, I got to tell you, I think this offense is running far better than anything that Maureen Wigg or Chan Gailey put out there with far more talent past 4 or 5 years. So, I, you know, Morton may need some seasoning. You know, it is his first year out there. But, you know, I like what he's been doing with that offense. He seems to be able to get separation for the receivers. And these receivers are not better than what they've had the last 3-4 years.
No, agreed.
So I like what he's doing. And, you know, I'm really a little upset about, you know, getting on for, you know, passing those three consecutive downs while they're on the 1-yard line last week. And, I mean, look, first off, they don't have a big back. They don't have Chris Ivory. They don't have Marshawn Lynch. They don't have a big back to get you that 1 yard. And second, they don't have any road graders on their offensive line. You know, and it's not as if that offensive line has really been moving people off the line of scrimmage. And also, I mean, as you know, the instant replay people not screwed the Jets and Safarian Jenkins yet again, they just scored the touchdown, everybody shut up. So, you know, I don't fault them for that play calling whatsoever.
No, I think that he's done a very good job. Hey, Jet, enjoy it. Best of luck, and I hope they lose.
Take care, John, and good luck at the Yahtzee table.
Okay, sounds good. See you at the bingos. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421 ESPN. Coming up next, Greg Bell of the Tacoma News Tribune. It's John Clayton.
This is the John Clayton Show.
Brought to you by Coors Light, the world's most refreshing beer.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Joining us right now, Greg Bell from the Tacoma News Tribune. And, Greg, I guess you know, some important things coming up here in the next 3 weeks to really see if this team is at the end of the cycle, is still in the mix for the cycle for the Super Bowl. I mean, where do you see this team with all the problems it has with injuries, running, offensive line? I mean, where do you kind of put this team heading into this three-game stretch?
Hi, John. Good morning. They're completely dependent on Russell Wilson, as if that's not obvious already. Every NFL team, of course, is dependent on their starting quarterback, and their season would change if without him. But no team has a guy that's getting 86, sometimes in the Atlanta game, for instance, 96% of its yards, scoring 96% of its offensive touchdowns. All but one touchdown this year has come from either Russell Wilson throwing or running. There's nobody in the Super Bowl era that has had a higher percentage of offensive touchdowns for his team than Russell Wilson has right now. And he's absolutely indispensable because of things like pass protection. It still isn't there consistently. Yes, the Seahawks had no sacks allowed last week in San Francisco, but I counted at least 6 times a normal quarterback would have been on the ground that Wilson escaped and avoided sacks. He's doing absolutely everything. And without blocking in the run game, without running lanes for Eddie Lacy and whoever else they're throwing in there, it'll be Mike Davis probably on Sunday night, it's Wilson. It's Wilson running away and pass calls and gaining yards and scrambles. 401 yards rushing this year leads the team, John. And as you know, 351 of those 401 is on rush, on scrambles, pass calls. So when you look at Seattle's offense and say, well, they're 20th in the league in rushing, well, they would be dead last without scramble yards from Russell Wilson. That's how indispensable he's been. And yet Carson Wentz and Tom Brady will get the MVP talk because their teams are 10-1 and 9-2. But the true value of most valuable, the true meaning of most valuable, you could argue very strongly that Russell Wilson's been that. So now he's going against the Eagles with their swarming front seven, and in the Jacksonville Jaguars next week in Florida has the number one. They have the number one ranked defense in the league, and then the Rams for the NFC West title. As long as they can stay within 1 game of the Rams, before that game in 3 weeks, that will determine the division.
Oh, no doubt. And I think that certainly the Atlanta loss changed everything in the sense that, you know, the margin of error was taken away with the Washington loss, and the loss to Atlanta pretty much just put them into the category where if they win the division, it's going to be a third or fourth seed, most likely. They're not going to get a number one or number two seed.
And that was the whole goal coming into this season. The day after they lost in Atlanta in the playoff game in January, Pete Carroll said, we need to not give away games in September, October, November, so that we are not on the road for the second round, which means you need to be a one or two seed in the playoffs. And we've talked about this before, John. That means you need to probably be 12-4 to assure yourself of first or second seed. Now, this year it might even be higher than that, but the way Minnesota and New Orleans are chasing Philadelphia right now. But you're right. If they do even beat the Rams and win the division, home playoff game in the first round, road playoff game at some hot team back east in the second round, whether it's Philadelphia or Minnesota or perhaps New Orleans, the way it's shaking out right now, or Carolina for that matter, at 8-3. And that's the recipe that's doomed them the last two Januaries. And again, everybody in Seattle doesn't need to be reminded of this. The only times this team has gone to the Super Bowl is when they've had home field advantage throughout the playoffs. That's what those Washington and especially the Washington loss has cost them. I think when they get to January, we're going to look back and say that loss when they gave up the touchdown late to the Redskins at home is the one that's going to send them on the road in the second round if they happen to win the division.
Yeah, because, I mean, the interesting part about this stretch is that, okay, so one game you don't have Earl Thomas, two games you don't have Cam Chancellor, and now you don't have him for the rest of the season. And yet during that stretch, they were able to hold teams to 214 yards in passing. And, you know, in some ways, a lot of those yards were in last drives. I mean, you know, the two completions made by Kirk Cousins, which are against man defenses, against young cornerbacks, probably, you know, had to maybe make an adjustment as far as what they should have done there. Then you go back and you see, you know, the last drive, I mean, the drive in the fourth quarter by Matt Ryan. And, of course, last week, some garbage yards at the end were meaningless. But, I mean, they've done a pretty good job of at least having good enough backups, guys with starting experiences, that the drop-off is still, there's going to be a drop-off. It's significant, but it's not as bad as other teams.
Right. There are, you don't have Byron Maxwell, who's already started here, and Jeremy Lane coming off the bench. On other teams, you have guys who've never done it before. Now, Lane at left corner, I think Maxwell's going to start at left corner Sunday night, and Shaquille Griffin coming off the concussion will go back to right corner. Justin Coleman will be the nickel. I think the one glaring flaw that they've had since Richard Sherman and Cam Chancellor have gone down is Jeremy Lane outside of cornerback, and teams have exploited that. Even the 49ers went after him a little bit, and they just happened to have C.J. Beathard, the rookie quarterback, overthrowing open receivers rather than hitting them like Matt Ryan and Kirk Cousins were doing. I think that that's what's going to happen, is you're going to see Maxwell now starting at left corner with Griffin back. What the Seahawks have done that I've noticed most in these games without Sherman and Chancellor is they've dropped more into coverage and blitz less. They blitzed Bobby Wagner only twice that I can remember last week at San Francisco, and Wagner happened to hit the quarterback both times. They were blitzing him a lot more earlier in the year and adding to their four-man pass rush. They're not doing that as much anymore because they're trying to reinforce the coverage and drop linebackers into coverage and help underneath to keep those fill-in corners and Bradley McDougal from having to get beat deep over the top. So now the reliance is on the front four. And that makes Michael Bennett hugely important, even more than he already is, without Cliff Averill with him. Frank Clark and Michael Bennett and Sheldon Richardson, for that matter, are really important in these last five games to get a pass rush so that the Seahawks can continue to drop seven into coverage and rush only four. If they can get pressure on Wentz with just four, that's really going to help them guard Zach Ertz down the middle tomorrow night.
No doubt, but of course the Eagles come in with an offensive line. They could arguably say that there's three Pro Bowl caliber guys on that line, Lane, you know, and it goes from center to the right side. And, you know, the team goes in Seattle a little undermanned because Deion Jordan's not going to play. Nazir Jones is not going to play.
Right. Jones got hurt stepping on a teammate's ankle in practice. Pete Carroll said he's doubtful and it doesn't sound like he's going to go. They're going to try to test him game time. Deion Jordan still has the neck stinger. So now Quentin Richardson becomes more important. Rodney Coe, who they just signed this week onto the active roster, becomes more important. Unproven guys. And then Sheldon Richardson, who has proven to be an every down guy and a stout one this season. I think, John, that Sheldon Richardson has been one of the top three players on the team. And the way he absolutely dominated the first half of that San Francisco game, just manhandling everybody on the offensive line, pushing 49ers blockers into running back, into Carlos Hyde, into C.J. Beathard, just wrecked the entire offense that San Francisco was trying to establish, especially in the run game early. That's two or three times this year he's done that. He says he's just now getting used to the 4-3 after the 3-4 years in the New York Jets for all the years that he was playing all over the place and even dropping in the coverage in the flat sometimes. Now they want him to be a three-technique defensive tackle, and he's said he's starting to master the nuances and the footworks and the gaps, and he could be another key for this team again because of how reliant they're becoming on the front four in particular so that they can free up seven men to play coverage. The thing about the Eagles as well, and they run the ball, and they're going to run the ball whether they're ahead or behind. They've been ahead so much this season that they could run it at their luxury and leisure. They've got four different running backs. They've got a Jay Ajayi, the former Miami Dolphin, who's their quicker guy, and they've got LeGarrette Blount to be their hammer. They've got guys who can catch the ball out of the backfield, a dynamic running back core. And a large reason, of course, why the Eagles are number two in rushing is because they've had big leads in games that they can run the ball so much.
No doubt. And, of course, now the big thing is you bring up the running game. I mean, where do you think this running game is going to be? Because it's a week-in and week-out guess as to how it's going to go, because basically they don't have a starting running back. If they do right now, it's probably Michael Davis.
I think it is going to be Mike Davis. He's going to be back. He's not even listed on the injury report because he came back to practice this week from that strain groin that cost him the last game against San Francisco. He was very impressive to the coaches in the surprise start he got against Atlanta, how decisively he ran on screen passes, up the middle on runs. And I think because he got hurt halfway into that game, they're still curious as to what else he can give. He only got two quarters in that role. I think they're going to go to him over Eddie Lacy. And I've really been digging and asking and talking to Thomas Rawls and people about Thomas Rawls. It seems to me he's done more than something just on the field football-wise for him to be so banished, so noticeably. I mean, one snap last week against San Francisco, that's the second game this year he's just gotten on the field for one snap. Tennessee was the other. And he's had two games he's completely inactive as a healthy scratch, the first two healthy scratches of his career. It's not like this running game is very hard to break into, John.
No.
So if he's not getting any chances, he's done, I think, something more than just what he's shown on the field. He's fully healthy. He was their lead back entering training camp. He was the guy they thought was the heir to Marshawn Lynch when Lynch retired in 2015 after that huge rookie season he had before he broke his ankle in December. And he's just not in their plans. That's become obvious. He could be a restricted free agent after this year, and they have shown no reason to think that he's going to be back in Seattle after this year. Pete Carroll said after that first healthy scratch, the most recent healthy scratch, before the Atlanta game, when John, an assistant, came over to him in the locker room and told him to take his shoulder pads off. He was already mostly dressed to go out on the field for pregame, and they told him to take his shoulder pads off. Pete Carroll said that he did not take that well. I'm wondering how unwell that was, and he might have just gone ballistic reading between the lines as to why he's not even getting a chance now, but it is Mike Davis and Eddie Lacy with J.D. McKissic. That's your three options at running back right now.
Yeah, I know. How do you think, would they expand McKittrick's role? Because, again, McKissic seems to be more of just that outside running threat, maybe take a quick shot, you know, do a screen pass. Where do you think he is?
We asked Daryl Bevel that very question a couple days ago. Would you expand? Is he an early down guy? And Bevel basically, in so many words, said, well, we've got what we think are early down backs, and we like McKissic in the third down role, and we like him as somewhat of a change of pace guy. Now, he'll start drives in there as well, as he did against San Francisco. Actually started the game against San Francisco, but that's offset and shotgun and usually running outside or catching passes outside. I think they like him still in that role. They still think Eddie Lacy can do something in the short yardage and early down roles. He just hasn't done it consistently enough. Pete Carroll said he saw for the first time last week that the offense felt his presence, felt his physicality. But Davis, I think, is going to get the just because they haven't seen a full game of him and they are intrigued and encouraged by his aggressiveness, I think it's going to be Mike Davis first. McKissick will stay in that third down role with C.J. Procise on injured reserve.
Yeah. Okay, so offensive line, do you see any improvement whatsoever?
Well, Dwayne Brown's obviously been an upgrade. I mean, anybody with 10 years of experience, three Pro Bowls, and an All-Pro is going to be better than what they were trying with Reece Odhiambo and before that George Fant at left tackle. So they've gotten better there. But even he has struggled somewhat. If you call a holding penalty on Dwayne Brown struggling, for his career it is. It was only his eighth holding penalty of his 10-year career last week against San Francisco. So even he's having trouble getting outside sometimes to cover the rush ends. Jermaine Ifedi is still a liability trying to get outside against speedy edge rushers. And he's going to have a problem with Philadelphia's front seven tomorrow night. Does that mean they keep Jimmy Graham in a block a little more than they have recently? Probably not, because of how well Graham has now caught fire with Russell Wilson and linking down the field. So they've got an issue there on the edge on the off of right tackle, and got to hope that Russell Wilson can just run away from them. They're going to go with Ethan Posick again, the rookie at right guard. Odey Obusi remains hurt, didn't practice much this week with the right shoulder, and I think even if he was fully healthy, he would not be unseating Posick. Tom Cable, the offensive line coach this week, John, said that he now wants to go with these five. He's got five. Now that Luke Jokel's back from knee surgery to play left guard, he'll go with Brown and Jokel and Britt and Posick and Ifedi from left to right and see what the continuity they can build over the last five games of the regular season. So that's who they got, and that's who they're going to go with. And with Obusi and Mark Lewinsky out, that's the fifth iteration of this offensive line this season. So they'll say it's getting better because there were no sacks allowed last week. But like I said earlier, I think that's because of Russell Wilson more than the offensive line.
No doubt. Hey, Greg, thank you so much. Greg Bell from the Tacoma News Tribune. I'll see you over there tomorrow.
Yes, sir. Have a good weekend. Thanks,
okay.
John.
Thank you. Greg Bell with Tacoma News Tribune. Read him. And, of course, give us a call here at 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. It's going to be a quick one because we're out at 11:30 because of Washington State basketball.
You're listening to The John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com. Now, more John Clayton.
Our thanks to Matt Nelson for running the show, producing the show. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Fast one here. Washington State basketball coming up. Let's go to Ed in Seattle. Hey, Ed.
Yeah, good morning, John.
Good morning.
I really still have confidence in these Seahawks. You just got to give Wentz some pressure. I know it's not going to be easy, but you got Bennett. You got Bobby Wagner. You got Clark, you got some other guys, Sheldon Richardson, they got to get to it. But the thing is, you know, regardless of, or in spite of the loss of Cam Chancellor and Sherman, obviously huge losses, the thing that we've lost since the beginning of the year, and you got, before I get into that, Russell Wilson has been magical. You got Tyler Lockett, you got Doug Baldwin, you got Jimmy Graham. He's still got some potential to put points on the board, with the exception of Blair Walsh. That trade was the biggest mistake we made.
It was a signing. It wasn't a trade. But you're talking about,
But the point being, if Russell could have rearranged his salary to bring in Dwight Freeney, why would you give up and now have to rely on a kicker that can only kick from 30 or 35 yards when you've got to create from 45 yards and throw in plays that you really don't want to because you can't trust the guy who can't hit a field goal, regardless of his 12 for 13 at the beginning of the season. He lost that Washington game.
I agree.
Three field goals lost. You can't. We got to go in the last five games. You got to depend on a few three-point situations. And when you can't depend on your kicker, if I was Pete Carroll, I'd be looking to the Sounders to bring in somebody else. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, right now, you're right. It's a situation that I think is very fluid, and, you know, to not do as well in these home games, that's not good. He's got a 50-yard leg. There's no doubt. He's got one of the strongest legs in the league, but he's got to get the accuracy and going. Hey, Ed, thank you for the phone call. Let's 866-979-ESPN. Let's go to Seahawks Sal. Hey, Sal.
Hey, John. How you doing?
Good. How you been?
I'm always listening, John, and I'm going to have to condense my notes, but, hey, it's not Walsh's fault we're losing these games.
No.
It boils down to the Seahawks have got to stop playing one half of football.
And, I agree.
I'm still optimistic. I'm hoping that the new old secondary gels, and I sure hope Baldwin emerges here in the last quarter of the season. Otherwise, yeah, you know what? We're just going to be a team like, you know, last year, maybe win a first round game. But you know, there's all the usual suspects, the O-line, but to me, it boils down to them playing one half of football and usually wait, thinking they got to pull it out in the last drive. And you know what?
Okay, hey, I've got to run here, but I agree 100%. They've got to get the offense going. So much of it, the defense plays the whole game for the most part. Offense does it. Hey, Washington State football coming up next. I'll be back Monday at 10, next week at 9. John Clayton.